renegade economist is saying, yeah.
Economics for activists. Economics is being made. Economics. These are the tools activists need now from the calculator. What motivates them? Why do people spend money? Understand the basics.
Today we have a climate special. We're interviewing Anna Rose from the Australian Youth Climate Coalition. Also Fred Folbury on the US meltdown, visiting academic to Australia. And we're lucky to have Ellis Levy back in the studio. Special hour-long edition of The Renegade Economist to finish off the year. And it's a very big warm welcome to Ellis. Where have you been, mate? What challenges have you been solving?
I've been up in Sydney for the last couple of weeks for the United Nations Youth Association's National Council. It was a great couple of weeks, especially the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights fell in the middle of it. So that was really exciting.
A two-week conference, that is something.
Well, it was two conferences, really, but yeah.
It was. Well, welcome back to the Renegade Economist.
It's good to be back, even in this, this week I've really wanted to wish that I was on some different planet, actually, since Monday. I just have been really a bit devastated by the announcement on Monday.
Yes, 5%, 5%, might as well be nothing. 1% were the back of the envelope stats we looked at by the time we took out the various subsidies and kickbacks to...
Free rides, anyone?
Yes, to... motorists and households. I think motorists are getting $2 billion out of the $11.5 billion raised, and households about $6 billion.
Not to mention the free permits that are going out to those who emit the most. What a bizarre approach.
I'm looking forward to chatting with Anna Rose from the Australian Youth Climate Coalition very soon. She's written an absolutely excellent article on New Matilda called Rudd's Emissions Target, a Policy Analysis. So she'll be coming up in not too long. But yes, we're here each week talking about sharing the worth of the earth with all. And not just ensuring that those carbon polluters or those land speculators make a mint and clean up without paying any real contribution back to society, thanks to the art of tax loopholes and the backflips accountants can perform for their very well-funded patrons. And so we must ask ourselves, why on earth is all this economic growth over the last 10, 15 years really failed the majority of us? You look at it, you hear that economic growth is going to provide jobs, it's going to provide security, it's going to hopefully provide us a house, somewhere to call our own. But as we well know, housing affordability is at record highs. Everything the Rudd government is doing is looking to maintain those property prices and at the expense of future generations and the present renting community.
It's just not something that people seem to factor into the economy these days. They just don't look at it. It's funny when climate change is on the tip of everybody's tongue and when natural resources and resource scarcity are things that preoccupy every single person every day, that people just don't factor in those sorts of resources into the way the economy works. It's this bizarre kind of take what you want for free system when the Earth's resources are quite clearly finite. And so I guess what we're on about is about working all of that into to make sure that a free market actually reflects the kinds of resources that are at the disposal of society and the way that they should be most equitably distributed.
Because really what's happening in the modern world is the tax systems globally look at income taxes and increasingly consumption taxes, but they forget about the ones where the massive profits are made, and that is in the buying and selling, the capital gains earned through flipping property, you know.
And it's not like this is a secret either. Like, everybody kind of looks at property markets and they look at empty blocks of land and they go, oh, ha ha, how about we, you know, buy that, speculate on it for a few years and then sell it off and we'll make some money. But ordinary people talk about it like this. So, and I mean, people come to the conclusions that the way to make easy money is to buy a house and then to sell it off a few years later. So, I guess the next step is for people to question it and really have a good long look at it and say, well, is that okay that I could do that if I had enough capital? Or is it okay that someone else can do it because they've got capital and I can't do it because I don't? So I guess working out the way that that can be, it's kind of a massive loophole in a system that a lot of people just don't challenge.
And so whilst the carbon reduction announcement was made earlier in the week, sliding in on the tails of that was more reports on the Henry tax review. Supposedly Wayne Swan has given them the mandate to have the most wide-ranging tax reform debate of all time. And we predicted it back on this show when the review was announced that all it would do is endorse expanding consumption taxes. And this is what's going on. Apparently, well, it seems like one of the only bold things they've done is said that stamp duties and payroll taxes should be removed, which we certainly agree with, but it seems that the only way that's going to be funded is by expanding consumption taxes, and it's not going to be the GST form of consumption taxes, so they won't get politically stung by that. But what it will be is some sort of a sin tax on tobacco and alcohol. As if beer isn't expensive enough as it is, they're going to pump it right up, and who knows, we'll be watching our favourite sport drinking cordial or maybe moonshine in years to come, I'm not sure. But it's very, very disappointing to see that, you know, the wisest minds in the country have no gumption to really stand up and say, listen, enough's enough. Property industries, speculative industries have dug this massive hole we're in today with this global financial meltdown. And here we go. We're just going to continue on as if nothing really happened and just make the poor pay more, because consumption taxes are across the board. They're a flat rate. And so people on low incomes pay the same amount as those on higher incomes, and that means as a percentage of our wage, we're paying more. So it really is not a good ticket forward. So, yeah, you know, these background stories, they're out there and they need to be told. And we didn't really get much time to go into Bribathon Brumby's efforts of recent in expanding the 2030 boundaries around Melbourne. Again, if you're thinking climate change, you're also looking at the expansion in road funding as well. It was still greater than what was to be given towards public transport. And so again and again, the lobbying forces, the real powers behind the political scenes get their kickbacks, and the rest of us who are in the old style form of democracy, thinking that our vote actually counts, are left behind. So Ellis, at your climate conference, was there discussion about trying to raise money to actually give, well, not bribes, but, you know, provide party funding for the major political parties?
Well, I think that the all the discussions, I mean, the conversations about climate change are on everyone's lips at the moment. But in terms of particularly young people campaigning, I don't think that it's so much, you know, raising the money and becoming a sort of lobbying stakeholder who's got big bucks to splash around to bribe politicians to do what they want is never really an option. I think that young people particularly are really committed to old-style democracy, in that they will write the letters, they'll go and stand at people's doors, they'll wave the banners. And then in terms of making a difference, I think that one of the things that people really try to convey, and certainly I know that I believe, is that young people are the key stakeholders in the future, and so you're looking at the people who are going to bear the brunt of the decisions that are made now and who have the most to win or lose, and who are therefore like really key parts of the decision making process, and they're so often overlooked, and it's a pretty, you know, it's an uphill battle, but at the same time, just opening people's minds to those voices that need to be heard in the debates as well is really critical. And I think that that's one of the things Anna also has another article on New Matilda that really emphasises the fact that Rudd's commitment to 5% is failing a generation. It's failing the young people who are going to inherit the world that didn't avert catastrophic climate change. And so, yeah, it's a really something that so many young people all around Australia are just appalled by, really. And it's frightening. It's a frightening indictment upon democracy as well, that there's not really that much of an outlet other than having big bucks to splash about. And unfortunately, it just seems like people doing good work are not necessarily those with lots of cash to spare, because they're more likely to be using it to build the future.
Well, Noam Chomsky certainly opened my mind up to another layer to lobbyocracy and the power vested interests have, and that is that a academic named Tom Ferguson from UMass University in Boston has developed a thing called the investment theory of politics. And he basically argues that whoever the biggest campaign donors are receive the biggest policy kickbacks. And so if you watch who the campaign contributions come from, you can pretty well predict where the policy cookie is going to crumble. So that was certainly something interesting. And you'll be able to find a link to that very interesting article by Chomsky on Democracy Now! Via our show notes, which we promise are going to be pumping again on earthsharing.org.au after a very, very busy few weeks. We're going to kick to a track and come back with Anna Rose.
Welcome back to the Renegade Economists, and we're here. We now have Anna Rose on the studio from the Australian Youth Climate Coalition. How are you going, Anna?
I'm well, Alice. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks so much for coming online to talk to us. We wanted to chat a bit about the implications of Monday's announcement about 5% as the stated target for Australia's carbon emissions reductions. What was your initial response when you heard that that's what Kevin Rudd's put on the line?
Well, look, it's very disappointing, and my initial response was, wow, I can't believe it's this low. We'd known all year that the government was under a lot of pressure from the polluting industries lobby, from companies like Rio Tinto and Woodside and groups like the Australian Institute Greenhouse Network to have low targets. What business was pushing for was 0%, and what the climate scientists have been saying is up around 40 to 50% reductions by 2020. So we kind of had thought the government would go somewhere in the middle of that range of what the science was saying, 40 to 50, and what business was asking for, which was zero. But for him to only do a 5% cut and then to talk about that as balance, well, it's definitely not balance. It's actually a recipe for climate disaster.
And Anna, we read in Crikey that you were in the lockup reading the white paper as it was before it basically hit the press. What were some of the murmurings going on amongst some of the other senior journalists in the room there?
Well, there were actually two lockups. There's one for journalists, and then there's one for business lobbyists and people from environment groups. And I was in that one. The comments that were going around were, I mean, there was a small group of us from the environment and youth community, and we were very, very upset because every time you turned a page, you just saw more terrible design elements of the scheme. I mean, the amount of money being given away to Australia's biggest polluters in this scheme is really, really bad. But then you had the other side of the room where all the industry lobbyists were sitting together, and they weren't looking unhappy at all. In fact, they were really looking like they'd gotten everything they'd wanted out of it. And one of the particular elements of this scheme that's in the white paper, which is very concerning, is the fact of compensation that companies are getting, and billions of dollars, $3.9 billion of free permits to the coal industry, and about $6 billion to other emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries. And the fact that these free permits to pollute, which are going to be personal property rights and can't be taken away once they've been allocated without compensation, these permits are tied to the amount of production that the companies essentially expand. So the more that the companies pollute, the more free permits they get. And because these permits are actually tax deductible, there are a lot of companies that are going to be making a profit out of this scheme, which is really moving away from traditionally environmental law has been about polluter pays, and this scheme's much more about pay the polluter.
It's I think that for a long time, a lot of people have seen that the climate change debate has really moved away from being an ideological question and even an environmental question into a really, an economic debate, a social debate, a really political debate. What are the implications of this this announcement and the white paper in relation to the environment movement? And given that, you know, green groups all around Australia and even internationally are reeling from the shock of such a low target, what's in store for the environment movement in 2009 in the lead up to Copenhagen in particular?
Well, we've got a big task ahead of us for 2009. We think that the Rudd government has really read public opinion wrong when it comes to their white paper. They think they can get away with this decision because it's close to Christmas, 1.7 million families have just received a $1,000 payout, everyone's busy with their Christmas shopping, obviously thinking about the financial crisis and all the other issues that we've got to deal with at the moment. But there's been a lot of anger expressed in the last few days. You've had spontaneous protests. We've organised a few of them in Sydney and Brisbane, Melbourne, all around the country. People, not just young people, but all kinds of Australians have been protesting this decision. We think the government has really underestimated the amount of public support that there still is in the community for climate change because, you know, as you said, it's a political question, and the Rudd government was elected on the promise and with the mandate of strong action on climate change, and they're really just throwing that mandate back into the faces of everyone who voted for them on that premise. So 2009 is going to be huge for the environment movement. We've got a lot of work to do before Copenhagen in 2009 in December. one of the things that we'll be focusing on is the international negotiations. And this 5% target has really derailed the international negotiations because other countries were expecting Australia to do a lot more. Even in Bali last year, they were talking about 25 to 40% cuts. So we've got to kind of keep working, keep building the movement, hold the government to account and really remind them that it's the Australian public that voted them in and the Australian public that can vote them out if they don't live up to their election promises.
So what do you think the next step for the government is? I mean, is there a way, I mean, politically and in terms of the way that the negotiations are going to continue, is there a way they can step up the targets over the next year? Is there a way, what are they likely to take as their next step, given that they've made this sort of massive concession to industry? What does it look like?
Well, the white paper is the government's policy. It hasn't obviously been turned into legislation yet. The next step in terms of the politics is this legislation will be introduced to Parliament in May and then it will go to the Senate after that. In terms of what the environment movement will be working on, I am anticipating that we'll be working on both houses of Parliament to get Labor senators to cross the floor to block this legislation because, frankly, it'd be better to have nothing at all than to have this emissions trading scheme in place. It's absolutely full of holes. It gives a huge wealth transfer to Australia's biggest polluters and the target is absolutely meaningless. So we'll be working with politicians in the House of Representatives to try to get them to block it and then in the Senate to try and get amendments. And the government will have to negotiate either with the coalition, who are still full of climate skeptics, or with the independents and the Greens, who particularly the Greens have obviously got a lot of problems with this model because it's not going to solve climate change at all. So there'll be a lot of wrangling, I think, middle of next year in the House of Representatives and the Senate. And then in terms of opportunities to change it, Copenhagen in 2009 is going to be the biggest UN climate negotiations ever. And I don't know how the Australian government is going to be able to justify their 5% target in the international arena. So there's definitely some potential if we get enough domestic pressure and enough international pressure for us to change their policies. And it'll just happen if we build a social movement big enough to push them to make those changes.
Well said, Anna, well said. And I was particularly shocked that companies like Alcoa are going to receive permits for 1 tonne of free emissions for every 0.7 tonnes included in their electricity bill. And this is a situation where Alcoa down in Anglesey is pulling dirty brown coal out of the ground for next to nothing. They're paying hardly anything back to the Victorian taxpayer. And, you know, the loopholes are just everywhere. And you point out there's another huge one with the unexpected overseas credits allowance. Can you explain to our listeners what that means?
Sure. Well, basically, in the green paper, which was the precursor to the white paper, when dealing with the issue of overseas credits, the government had said, look, there's going to be a limit on how much carbon credits will be allowed to import from overseas to meet Australia's target, because the point of a carbon pollution trading scheme is to reduce Australia's carbon pollution and actually drive that structural change that we need in our economy domestically, and that means moving away from coal and moving towards renewable energy, moving away from private transport and more into public transport, making sure that energy efficiency services are a core part of the economy. So all of these structural economic changes that you can only get from things that we do at home, you know, you can't put a solar panel on your house by exporting it to China and moving it back. A lot of this work has to be done in Australia and it will create new jobs, new industries, new investments. But the thing with overseas credits is, and there are a lot of really problematic social justice issues with these credits, things like tree plantations where Indigenous communities have been moved off their land in order to create carbon credits to be sold at low prices to companies in Australia who then buy their way out of their emission reduction obligation instead of making the changes that they're supposed to be making at home. So that's the kind of situation with carbon credits from overseas. Now, in the white paper that was released on Monday, the government has said, well, there's no limit on the amount of overseas carbon credits that can be imported to meet Australia's measly 5% target. So theoretically, we could actually not do anything in Australia at all, not build one new single wind farm, not build one new solar farm, because if overseas credits are cheaper and we're putting the burden on developing countries, which by the way, haven't caused the problem. It's countries like Australia which have. Then, you know, we're just totally shirking our responsibility to the rest of the world to make those changes and make Australia the most sustainable nation in the world. You know, we have such a small population and such a huge opportunity in terms of renewable energy and an intelligent and educated populace who cares about the issue, that if we can't do it here, how can we expect other countries to do it where they are?
Thanks for that, Anna. In terms of next year as well, we're just about out of time at the moment, but there is certainly, there's going to be heaps of landmarks for the environment movement in terms of getting all of these issues, making sure that they stay in the spotlight and really putting the pressure on at home and abroad. One particular event that's definitely going to feature in terms of young people in Australia is Power Shift, which is going to be held in April next year. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Absolutely. Just briefly, Power Shift is the National Youth Climate Summit. It'll be held in Sydney in April 17th to 19th, bringing together thousands of young people from around Australia to build a generation-wide movement to solve climate change and to be used as a platform for young people to have our voices heard in the national debate on climate change, because really when it comes down to it, it's our generation that's going to be the most affected and our generation that has the last opportunity to solve it.
Excellent, Anna. Well, thank you very much for joining us today on the program. You've done a great job in raising our awareness here, and keep up the good work.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks,
Anna.
Very
good
much.
Luck.
My freedom.
Fontella Base. My God, my freedom, my home. Well, aren't we lucky we've still got planet Earth left? But you wouldn't know it. You really would not know it. And by God, baby boomers, I call you to attention. I was shocked coming out of an event recently called Voices of the Pacific, and I shared an elevator with one of those beautifully manicured grey-haired men. And the whole forum was about how the Cataract Islands and throughout Melanesia, many countries are having to move to higher grounds. And Nick McClellan had just returned from there telling us all these harrowing stories about how populations are having to move already because sea levels are rising, extreme weather is building, and, you know, salt is changing soil compositions. And anyway, I made the comment that isn't it shocking that land speculators and those in the know are buying up high grounds wherever you look around the world in expectation of this occurring over the next, you know, 5, 10, 20 years. Who knows, it might be 3 years away. Plain Jane Rudd is going with his politics. Anyway, this guy said, oh, whoa, don't start thinking like that. Don't start talking like that. That doesn't happen. Don't think about that. And, oh, my God, I responded, and he just looked the other way, basically turned his back on me. And I was like, geez, mate, wonder how you make your money. But I was fuming that, you know, this generation that spent many time in the 60s in psychedelic spheres connecting with the Earth have all but given up on us and cannot even look outside the square. So now when we hear Anna Rose from Australian Youth Climate Coalition telling us that under the new Rudd climate buddy kickback scheme, they're going to be able to import carbon credits from Papua New Guinea and some of these other Pacific Island countries. Now, having just returned from Vanuatu and telling you in the poor state of the valuation of natural resources, one can imagine that the Asian Development Bank and those other big honchos are out there giving these bureaucrats a bum steer on what the value of their rainforests and carbon sinks are really, truly worth. So this is another side to the equation we must look at if we're to ensure an equitable place on this earth for every human being, if in fact we do have an equal birthright to this planet.
And it's a funny kind of idea, putting a dollar value on a forest or a, but it happens in terms of what gets, you know, cut down and mined and extracted from the earth. So it's really important that we start looking at ways to label to some degree the resources that remain in their natural state and the kinds of benefits that they produce for the economy. Like when you're talking about emissions trading, you're talking about carbon sinks having a monetary value, and it's important that those things aren't underestimated and that they are recognised for their complete worth in a free market context, because that's kind of where we are really. The way that the market has evolved to dominate relations between states and between individuals, and the way that it's also evolved to potentially compromise our interest in natural resources and our interest in an equitable society and all of those sorts of things. We can't avoid economics in these questions, and so we've got to start building it in a way that accurately reflects the role of natural resources in the equation. So it's going to be tough to work out exactly how much old growth trees are really worth, but I think if you start off with priceless and then you try and put some dollar figures on, then you're kind of on the right track.
Yes, and to think there are no efficiency gains to be had from clean air, we just have to add up the costs from asthma and similar respiratory diseases. You know, there are phenomenal effects through our water and the amount of plastic chemicals that are floating through our bloodstream now. All of these things are adding up, and cancer rates are just jumping through the roof, and the Earth's biosphere, as we know, is under tragic threat. And here we go, you know, the Henry Review's released their basic feedback on the tax review this week. The Rudd government's come out with their climate change policy. And sliding in as well today, Senator Faulkner's released his green paper on electoral reform. And so that is an interesting move. Will plain Jane politics prevail again, and the lobbyists will be looked after? The public opinion polls will water down any real power or, you know, forceful change. And to think that Rudd's imagining himself on the same level as the Hawke Keating government, who actually engaged in serious economic reform that threatened their own constituency, the trade union movement, went ahead with it. Then the Liberal government, the Howard government, cleaned up with those economic gains. Now we've got the Rudd government dragging their feet. So keep an eye on that one. John Faulkner's just released the Electoral Reform Green Paper. Let's hope they follow similar lines in New Zealand, where each election part of the permit for broadcasting as a TV or radio station is that free airtime must be given to political parties. And this fits in within our overall philosophy that the earth belongs to all, as that electromagnetic spectrum is a very important natural resource that is worth millions and millions of dollars.
It's I've heard the Rudd government criticised for its excessive consultation. I'm not entirely convinced that it's worth criticising them for. I think that it's been really good to see a government that seeks to engage with the public and seeks to have people's opinions involved in their decision making. What we need to do now that all these reports and these white papers and the green papers are being released is make sure that we continue to engage with them, that we push them to take what people have said on board and to really move forward and to make sure that they're genuinely looking at all different perspectives and that they're thinking outside the box and they're really seizing this opportunity to make some real difference. And to make some really profound changes. I think that's a huge part of democracy, is holding the government accountable. So get involved, look at that green paper, look at that white paper, and don't shut up until they do what they say they will.
That's true. All right, now, last Thursday we had a flyby visit from one of the sharpest minds in our movement. His name is Fred Foldry. He's a senior lecturer at the University of Berkeley, and he hit the nail on the head like few have before in just 30 minutes. I'm putting that interview up on our earthsharing.org.au website tomorrow. Sorry, his speech, but we're just about to play a 13-minute pre-record we did with him, so sit back and listen to some of the background reasonings behind this global financial meltdown, and hopefully you can tune into some of these points. We're here with Fred Foldry, master writer from the Progress Reports at progress.org. Make sure you check it out, where you can see all sorts of interesting topics, varying from slants on breast cancer to the latest on the subprime to what Obama's really up to. Now, Fred, why has this global financial meltdown occurred?
It's occurred because of the real estate cycle. Every downturn has been preceded by a real estate boom, every major downturn. Yeah. And the United States has had a real estate cycle for 200 years, and there are similar cycles in other countries. And what happens is you have a real estate boom caused by credit expansion, and fueled by land speculation. It peaks out, it's unsustainable, and then it crashes, and it brings down the financial system. So what's been happening this year has happened in the past. It happened in 1990 with the savings and loan in the U.S., and it's just a recurring thing. It's the biggest since the Great Depression, because the real estate boom in the past 10 years was the greatest since the 1920s.
Many people say the subprime led to the meltdown. How do you see that, and what really are the underlying causes?
Yeah. The subprime mortgages was just the tip of the iceberg. So it was mortgages in general, of which the subprime ones were the riskiest. But the underlying issue is the land boom. Because when real estate prices were escalating, it's really the land value that goes up, not the value of the building. And the central economic fact is that land values capture the benefits of an economic expansion. And so during economic expansion, the problem is that what government services provide, the infrastructure, the schooling, streets and highways, security, all of these services increase the value of land. But most of it is paid for by taxes on labor and enterprise. And therefore, land values go up. And then when speculators see land values go up, they can make a fortune through leveraging by buying real estate. So the speculative demand adds to the real demand for land. But it carries land values too high because they keep looking at future prices. They look for the next buyer to buy from them. And eventually it becomes unrealistic. And those people who buy at the end of the cycle, then they face large losses. And what's made the problem much worse this time around is the secondary market for mortgages. You had the institutions Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, government-sponsored enterprises that were buying mortgages from the originators, from banks that would originate mortgages. So it used to be that the bank would loan money for a mortgage, and then the bank held that mortgage. But now the banks can simply sell that mortgage to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which in turn package them and sell it to insurance companies, hedge funds, and other firms. And so therefore, the banks can just keep churning it. They just keep issuing more and more mortgages, and they don't care so much about the quality because they can sell those mortgages. And so that made it, it may appear that they're benefiting homeowners by making mortgages easier to get, but it's a cruel hoax on poorer people who are then stuck with a foreclosed property.
Were all of these subprimes channeled through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Was that how it went, or is it wider than that?
No, it was wider than that. Fannie Mae was restricted on certain amounts of mortgages. So the larger mortgages went through Freddie Mac. And there were also other firms that jumped in for the secondary market. But they would, the thrust of it was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And so there were mortgage brokers and others that were also handling these mortgages.
And so as capitalism is under the microscope at present, some are saying that it's, you know, just a market failure. That's what led this to happen. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, it was not at all a market failure, because you have to look at the issue way beyond just regulation into government intervention. And the intervention includes the tax system and subsidies, including guarantees. So when you have government subsidizing land values by providing public services which are paid for through labor, taxes on labor and goods, that is a huge subsidy. So that's not a free market. And then you, on top of that, you'd have tax breaks for real estate, tax-deductible mortgages, tax-deductible property taxes, and tax-free sales or exemptions from capital gains taxes. All of these things are government subsidies to real estate, so that's not a free market. Any subsidy like that is not a free market phenomenon. Then you have the guarantees on mortgages by the Federal Housing Administration and other government agencies, and the implicit government guarantee of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which when they failed became an explicit guarantee as the government took over these agencies at a cost of many hundreds of billions of dollars. So all of this government subsidy, guarantee, tax systems and all of that, that's nowhere near a free market.
Certainly, certainly. And the U.S. GDP is at about $14 trillion a year. We did some back-of-the-envelope sums before and said that land values throughout the U.S. would be approximately $35 trillion. And what you're saying is that the government, through the average working-class person paying their labor taxes, meanwhile the land speculator and the top 1% can dodge their taxes with their accountants doing backflips through all sorts of loopholes. What percentage do you think these infrastructure services and general health services and the like that the working class man pays for contributes to this $35 trillion asset bubble?
Well, almost all of the land value is basically from subsidies. Because if the homeowners and real estate owners, the commercial owners, had to pay for the full cost of all the government services that pump up their land value, that would capitalize land values back down. And a lot of that $35 trillion is speculation, the speculative demand on top of the real demand. Of course, Australia, the same thing. So it's hard to put an exact number. There's no real study about how much of the land value is speculative, but I would imagine it's substantial.
And so the solution so far from the neocons in power, GW and Crew, has been to bail every single entity out, virtually. Mm-hmm. And it's just been $1 after another thrown. Someone wrote a nice article, $7 trillion into the breeze. Right. What response have all these bailouts, the Citigroup and the like, really going to deliver? And on the flip side, what should they be doing if they were serious about addressing this issue?
Yeah, this is a bailout to the financial industry, of which contributes money to politicians, and many of the people there, like the U.S. Treasury Secretary, come from the financial industry, so they're helping out their friends. And their excuse was that without bailing out the insurance companies like AIG and the banks like Citigroup, the whole financial structure would fall apart. But the fact is, credit was already frozen, and all of this has not really unfrozen credit. Now, of course, it's hard to tell what would have happened without all this money, but I imagine it really hasn't done that much good. The economy is still receding, house prices are still falling, and if they really want to turn the economy around, a much more direct way to do it would simply to give money to the people. I wrote one of my columns on that, which is called Money to the People. If the U.S. government would simply give every resident $6,000 in cold cash, just print the money and give it to them, right? It would be less than the $7 trillion that they have spent or pledged already, because that amounts to $23,000 per U.S. citizen. And people would then have money. They would buy goods or pay off debts or put the money in banks. All of those would do some good. And it would be a counter to the deflation that's going on right now. Right now, the U.S. economy, and I imagine others, are going through a deflation, falling prices. And a deflation is bad for a severe deflation is bad for business, because someone borrows money, and then you have to pay back in more expensive dollars because prices have fallen. And so people then are reluctant to borrow money in a deflation. So I think that's what the government could be doing, is giving money directly to the people instead of to the financial interests. But they're not doing this because they're using this crisis as an excuse to give favors to the moneyed interests that then contribute to their campaigns.
And so Ben Bernanke spent the early 1990s in Japan and basically cut his teeth there as a young man and saw Japan kick into what became a 16-year recession. And during this time, they faced a land price deflation. For many of us, we were looking at this saying, well, that's true, that's what needs to occur. Land prices have to drop so people are spending less on rent and there's more money for food and fun and general saving and investment. And it sounds like that's what's happening in America at present. Should this be encouraged, or should they be doing what they're doing in Australia, where they're basically bailing out the property industry and trying to prop up real estate prices so that there's some money for banks to leverage against, to lend out more money? You know, this whole credit hoax of you know, there needing to be liquidity in the market, who is really going to invest when people are having to spend so much on rent?
Bernanke should have foreseen the U.S. problem, having known about the Japanese boom and bust. But I guess people thought, well, it's different here, and it really wasn't. The problem is that there's a ratio of house prices to rents, because people own houses that they rent out. And so during the boom, the ratio of house prices to rents has gone up. House prices went up more than house rents, because when people rent housing, they pay for actual use. But when people buy housing, a lot of that is speculative. The speculators are paying a lot more relative to the rents. So house prices have to fall in order for the economy to really recover. That ratio has to go back to the normal ratio. So house prices should fall. They should allow house prices to fall. And when they prevent house prices from falling, they're just delaying the recovery.
In closing, Fred, what do you think will occur over the next few years? What can we expect, and how can our listeners prepare themselves for it?
Well, in America, Obama has announced a big public works program, so they're going to spend billions of dollars on infrastructure, roads, highways, and so on. Now, if a bridge has to be built or repaired, then certainly do it, but not to make work, but because you need the bridge, right? But just spending for public works for the sake of making jobs, it really does not lead to economic recovery. In fact, that's what happened in Japan. They spent tremendous amounts of money on public works, which really weren't that productive, but just to stimulate the economy, and it did not end the stagnation. And in the 1930s, Roosevelt, who seems to be the role model for Obama, Roosevelt and the U.S. government spent a lot of money on public works. Now, they did build some things that were useful, but it didn't get the economy out of the recession or the depression. So, unfortunately, what we're going to see is public works programs and more bailouts. Now, how fast the economy recovers depends on tax policy and monetary policy.
Thank you, Fred.
You're welcome.
We're standing here at the first Flock and Flog. Raina, what's this all about?
Well, this is the world's first direct action craft market. We're protesting against the rampant land speculation in the middle of Melbourne, which is making rental space really expensive, which makes retail really boring, which means that crafters like us can't set up shop anywhere, we can't afford it, and we can't even really afford to get our products into the stores, because by the time you put a rental markup on the products, they're just too expensive for people to buy. So, to make things even more fun, the council's bloody in with the developers and the landlords, and you can't even sell stuff on the street without paying council. So we decided that stuff that we're not interested, we're taking to the streets, direct action, and we've set up our own craft market. We're just behind the city council, and they keep wandering past looking at us going, what the hell? But yeah, we're having a roaring little trade here. Lots of people are very interested to see what these crazy ladies are doing in an alleyway.
As we look down on the stall here, we see Respect Your Box plastered over a pair of women's underwear, a legalised abortion maternity top, an alternative energy cross-stitch jumper, and some sort of funky hoodie. Yeah, it's all by handmade. Why is that important with Christmas coming?
Because if you support handmade stuff, you're actually supporting your community. If you go and buy stuff that's made in a sweatshop and sold in a chain store, then very little of that money is actually going to get recirculated back into your community. So in the end, it does make things more expensive for you. And it's really boring, that sort of stuff. You know, there's so many wonderful designers and makers and artists and crafters who are making such great stuff around, and absolutely our dollars should be going to those people instead of the landlords of the big shopping malls who are making absolute millions out of selling crap.
So buy handmade is the pledge for this summer, for this Christmas. Where can people find out about future such events?
Well, there's a whole lot of markets in Melbourne. We're running random renegade guerrilla craft markets, which you can find out about through craftcartel.com. But if you search Melbourne markets on the internet, you'll find hundreds. Or whatever town you are in, you know, search markets and you'll find them, because they're in every town, whether they're farmers markets or craft markets or art markets or both.
Well, thank you very much for that snappy little interview.
Hey.
We've got an interesting event coming up, Melburnians. It's called Unsilent Night. What does it mean, Linda?
Unsilent Night is in its third year in Melbourne. It's where we swarm groups of people to come together with a sound piece that's been composed by a New York composer called Phil Klein. And we create a sound swarm with multiple audio devices, and we walk through the city.
So what? So it's like a whirling pile of mosquitoes that changes into honking car horns. What are some of the sounds, and why is this an important thing for people to be involved in?
Phil Klein has created this piece as an ambient sound work. So the idea is that it is an electronic immersive experience using bells, electronic washes, and it's like trying to create a euphoric experience that's alternative to just the standard Christmas carolling or getting out in the street and consuming on just before Christmas.
So a bit of a sensory awakening as hundreds of weirdos walk through the streets all dressed in their non-branded clothing, I bet. I bet most of it's handmade too. But is that part of the thing, awaken people up out of this consumer lifestyle they're living?
In a really gentle way. In lots of ways, this is a very inclusive experience. We want everybody to come down. And the whole premise of Unsilent Night is that anyone can do it in any of their local towns. So it's about doing a global event that brings a lot of people together without having any basis for, you know, shopping or flying anything.
And these goddamn New Yorkians, they've been behind this, haven't they? Well, tell us the vibes there and how you discovered this.
Well, I discovered it 4 years ago in Sydney, and I was a participant in Sydney's first Unsilent Night. Unsilent Night's been happening since 1992. So I think it's in its 16th year, and New York, there's about 2,000 people that show up, and it fills up like two blocks of the city. So it's really huge, and we'd love to see as many people come down to Melbourne.
So what are the details?
We're meeting at 6 p.m. At the State Library steps on Swanson Street. We're gathering together. We're sorting out boom boxes, tape players, MP3 players. We've got some stuff. We hand out tapes, CDs. We can also go to Unsilent Night's website, which is www.unsilentnight.com.
And that's this Thursday night. What's the date?
The 18th. That's a test. 18th. I'm trying to remember my dates here. I'm pretty sure it's the 18th of December.
Okay, 6 p.m. on the steps as always. Should be fun. Thanks very much, Linda.
No problems.
What a colourful world we do live in. And there we have a couple of women from the Melbourne Craft Circle, Craft Cartel. Last night had a little impromptu stall. Watch out, there may well be another one next Monday night. Check out the website to stay posted.
There's heaps of stuff you can get involved in. Christmas is a great time to get involved in making people think about their communities and think about the people that they're sharing their life with on this beautiful planet that we are just going to have to bust our asses next year to protect. So get involved, check it out. Check out the links on www.earthsharing.org.au.
Thank you very much for our first full calendar year on 3CR. This will be our last formal show for the year. We will be providing musically inspired, economic related, kind of semi-inspirational thinking music over our summer break and be back mid-January. So, yeah. Fire up, write those letters to your politicians, keep reading, keep thinking. We've got to turn this around.
Have a safe and happy and peaceful festive season.
The green plastic watering can for a fake Chinese rubber plant.